Hello and welcome to the Three Donkeys podcast. My name is Tyler Bielman. I'm here with Scaff Elias.
Hello.
And Richard Garfield.
Hello.
And we're here to talk to you about some news of the week in, as it pertains to table games. And then we're going to go into a conversation about cooperative games, Dungeons and Dragons, and things of that nature. But first, right off the bat, you know, you can't talk about tabletop games without talking about what's going on with Konami and Upper Deck as it pertains to the giant trading card game Yu-Gi-Oh! Apparently, everything's been sorted out to a degree. Upper Deck has stopped saying they're going to publish anything. They've stopped their organized play. And they're being accused by Konami of actually printing counterfeited cards through a shell company called Vintage Sports Collectibles, which is all very interesting. And as that as Yu-Gi-Oh! Goes away, they'll have to look for other businesses like the World of Warcraft miniatures and this new Huntic TCG that is coming out. And Huntic, I don't know the ratings on Huntic. Does anybody know how well that TV show does? As we all know, TV shows are very important.
No idea. But they also have the World of Warcraft trading card game, too.
So. Oh, yeah. That's right.
I know nothing about Huntic.
Yeah. It's debuting this week, and it seems to be a zonal-based game where you're moving guys forward in a zone, and one guy has an objective of grabbing a card and bringing it back. So it looks like it's got elements of Warlord, potentially. Yeah.
But you haven't played it.
Haven't played it, but there is a YouTube video. If anybody wants to check it out, you can go to the YouTube video.
And do you know anything about the show?
I know nothing about the show, except they're a hidden organization of there's an organization of kids called Seekers, and it looks to be like an Indiana Jones kind of vibe, where they're out looking for artifacts.
What age group? Yu-Gi-Oh?
Yeah, definitely, right down the middle. So that'll be interesting and is something to look out for. In that same vein, another release that's coming out is Battle Spirits, created by Mike Elliott, whom we all know from Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah, and designer from Wizards, very talented.
Yeah, it's a good, really good game.
Have you played it?
I have seen it played. Demoed, yeah.
Yeah.
I played it. I played it with him.
Yeah, I haven't played it at all, but apparently it's the number three game in Japan behind Duel Masters and Yu-Gi-Oh!, and they're bringing it here. So can you talk about the game a little bit, since you guys have seen it?
It's a trading card game with elegant mechanics. It's got monsters on all the cards. So superficially, it looks like a Yu-Gi-Oh! Type of product, with a monster on every card and moves and things like that. It plays very quickly and has a lot of strategy.
Yeah, apparently it's coming. They're going to show it at Gamma in April, and I don't know that much more about it. I assume they're bringing TV with it. I know it's from Bandai. I think there's a TV show in Japan.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, there is TV in Japan, is what I've heard, and some of the mechanics in it are reminiscent of Duel Master, which Mike Elliott was one of the principal designers on. So, that's not surprising.
And they've announced that it's going to be exclusive to the Hobby Channel through 2009, which is kind of an interesting move, given that, the mass market's where moms and the kids go. How do you feel about that move?
Well, maybe the TV is being delayed or something like that. That's the only thing the only reason I could see. It's obviously more difficult to get distribution in, outside of the hobby, and perhaps that has something. Those things might be tied together.
Yeah, TV is critical for it to go big. Duel Master was very successful in Japan, but it was kind of flat in the States, partially because, or maybe mostly because, the TV show was flat.
Excellent. Well, in our last news item, apparently a guy named Rick Edelman, who worked with Decipher, he was the VP of finance. He has pled guilty in a circuit court in, I'm not sure where, to 12 counts of embezzlement to the tune of $1.5 million. He took that out of Decipher in, it looks like, 2001. He faces a maximum sentence of 12 years. That's kind of interesting. We've known a little bit about graft at our time at Wizards of the Coast, correct?
No comment.
Okay.
No comment.
Well, I think that, Decipher, $1.5 million must have been a fair amount of their profits for that year, for those years. But
yeah, maybe more than 100%.
Yeah. But one thing when I was looking at Decipher is that they have a new TCG coming out called Fight Club with K-L-U-B. And apparently you need an invitation to join Fight Club. And I looked around and apparently nobody's talking about it, which I guess might be part of the marketing campaign. But
yeah, I've heard you hang out in parking lots late at night and you might get an invitation from somebody. I haven't gotten one yet, so I don't know anything about the game.
But you spend a lot of time in parking lots late at night.
I've been hanging out, waiting. I've been offered other things, but not invitations to Fight Club. I should mention that this problem with embezzlement is not a big problem in the game industry, just because the game industry makes so little money, except at the top.
The other thing about the Fight Club thing is it seems like it's built on some kind of deliberate pyramid scheme, from what I can tell. It looks like if you are a mentor and you recruit somebody, you get some kind of percentage on how many packs they buy, which I don't understand at all, but it seems like it's an interesting time to try something like that.
Is the embezzlement guy still working for the club?
He might be, but it seems unlikely. He was the brother-in-law of the founder of Decipher, so you never know. This might be his way out.
In the game Monopoly, you can work very well from jail. So
that's a good point. All right, we're on to our main topic for the day, which is Dungeons and Dragons and cooperative games. It begs the question: is Dungeons and Dragons a cooperative game?
Not the way my group generally plays it.
Are you the DM in your campaign?
No. I'm just someone who no one listens to.
I see. Well, they're listening to you now. Is there anything you'd like to say?
I think Dungeons and Dragons, it really depends on the playgroup, whether it's a cooperative game or not, in that sometimes the way some people play, I don't even think it's a game, because the you're going to win ahead of time. It's more of a joint storytelling experience. And sometimes the Dungeon Master is very antagonistic to the players and takes things personally. And in those situations, I think it's almost sort of a very asymmetrical competitive game. But the way the vast majority of people play, I would say, yeah, it is a cooperative game, where it's right down the middle, where the Dungeon Master is really more of a referee, almost a part of the system. And then the group of players is attempting to cooperatively play and successfully meet whatever challenge has been set up. So, yeah, in general, it's a cooperative game.
What about other cooperative games? Are there other games that are similar in that way, where you have a referee whose job is to essentially create balance between the goal and the players?
Well, there's not so many. I mean, all role playing games. The vast majority of role playing games work that way. But there are a bunch of cooperative games where people work on the same side. And the rules of the game act as the moderator.
I think the biggest category there is computer games. There's a lot of computer games that work that way. That's how most MMORPGs work, where the program is taking over the role of the Dungeon Master. And things like Halo or whatever, or Gears of War is a really good example, where you are supposed to play as a team versus the computer. That's probably maybe the primary mode of play.
Well, contrast the differences between having a computer that's providing the rules set and keeping track of the state and everything versus a human being able to do that.
Well, like I said, I think with a human, the at least the ideal for me when I'm playing is that when the Dungeon Master is actually working a lot like the machine is working, where they really are there to more adjudicate the rules, and things can go poorly or they can go well. And the biggest difference, I think, is because it is a person, they can sometimes want to help the players too much, in which case, like I said, it's less of a game and more of a joint storytelling experience. And then sometimes they really start to get mad that the players have done something they're not expecting, or that they don't feel the way it should go, and it can be pretty antagonistic, and then it's more of a two-sided sort of affair. But
yeah, the cooperative games work pretty well where you've got sort of a deist view of the universe. You've got a God set the game in motion, and now it's operating by clockwork, and And in most role-playing games, you've got the person who's adjudicating that, you know, might actually mess with the clockwork mechanisms.
And these are obviously personal opinions. A lot of people really like when you know they are going to automatically win because that's what the Dungeon Master is doing. But you know, everybody's different.
You touched on something interesting when you talked about the cooperative storytelling aspect of it. Let me ask a question. When you guys were first putting Magic together, did you feel like when you were playing games of Magic that you were telling stories, that you were creating stories?
No.
Not even a little bit.
Yeah, and I asked that question. Actually, I was in front of a group of students talking about story in games, and I asked that question, and nobody said that. And then I asked them about World of Warcraft also, and they said, in no way did they feel like it's a storytelling experience. And I think the main difference between those is that there is a human referee guiding you towards telling that story together.
Well, I don't feel like it's a storytelling experience when I play Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, I thought you said earlier that you did feel that way.
You said some sessions.
Sometimes the Dungeon Master can take it upon themselves to make sure that no matter what happens, there's a success going on from the player's perspective. And in that circumstance, when the Dungeon Master is no longer impartial, but really trying to help the players win, that moves it toward the cooperative storytelling experience.
So let's talk about other cooperative games that people like. Shadows over Camelot was kind of a big cooperative game that a lot of hardcore gamers talk about.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting game, and it's only semi-cooperative in that there is usually an antagonist, somebody on the other side. This category of game in board games is not actually very big. There's not many of them. There's the Lord Call of Cthulhu cooperative game. There's the Lord of the Rings cooperative game, and a handful of others. Pandemic recently. One of the major problems with that form of game, they're fun to play for a little while, but once you solve it, you don't have an arms race against an opponent. You've got an arms race against a game system. And so that helps the Shadows over Camelot a lot because you can get better or worse traitors.
Well, the Warhammer Quest stuff works that way too.
Because there's a human...
No. I mean, they're also a cooperative game.
Yeah, Warhammer Quest is cooperative.
There's Betrayal at House on the Hill, which was a Wizards Avalon Hill release.
Another with a traitor among you.
Yeah.
And those sort of get into almost a different category. They kind of feel like cooperative games, but they do end up being two sides: Shadow over Camelot and Betrayal at House on the Hill.
Generally an asymmetrical.
Very asymmetrical, which adds to the feeling that it's a co-op game and that just one person is sort of outside the game.
Yeah, you mentioned Pandemic, and Pandemic is a pretty purely cooperative game.
Oh, very. Although I've heard that the expansion, which is being designed by Tom Lehman, is going to add a second side to it. Somebody's going to play the disease, so that should be fun.
Dated her.
One of the big problems with these games in general is the problem of people making your decisions for you. When I'm playing Pandemic, the first time I was playing, I didn't know how to play, and somebody's telling me how to play, and they were telling me what I should do, and that's something I've run into in all these games, including Dungeons and Dragons. But there are things in the better ones which mitigate that, including especially in Dungeons and Dragons.
My main problem with Dungeons and Dragons is when the other players don't listen to the decisions I've made. That's kind of annoying.
Yeah. That's why playing computer games is so much better. The computer listens to you. So in a game like Pandemic, if somebody's telling you what to do, if there's a group of four people, at its best, it's like a group problem solving. But in practice, often there's one person who's played before or two people who are really good at the game, and other people listen to what they suggest they do, and then they do it if they want to win it, and they if they want more of a challenge, they do what they think they ought to do.
Yeah, and everything just breaks down. The great saving grace of Dungeons and Dragons is that even though you're all trying to win, you're not all trying to make optimal decisions at every point. That's the whole role-playing aspect, which I think is maybe underrated in terms of it solving this problem. Like, I can tell you that you shouldn't charge into battle, but you're the half-orc barbarian, so you're going to charge into battle, and it's difficult for me to say. I mean, I've never heard anyone say, you know, I think you're not quite role-playing well. Perhaps you should do this or that, because that would feel more like yourself.
So this is an interface where the flavor in the world very much impacts mechanically what goes on in the game.
Well, it's more than flavor in the world. It is the idea of role-playing. There's a lot of flavor in a game like World of Warcraft. And some people do role-play there, but really most people are just playing it as a game. They do whatever they think is tactically the best.
And it is a cooperative game. When you put together a party on a raid, everybody has their role. They're all working together against the system to try to beat the mob.
Yeah, generally. It's a cooperative game. So it's way more to do with the flavor. It's this idea that you're supposed to be playing a character, and so sometimes you're going to make decisions based on what you think that character would do rather than what you think would help you win the game.
And I think that's a much more critical thing in paper tabletop games, because there's very few of those that have the press, you know, time pressure. In a computer game, generally you have this time pressure where it's almost impossible for people to play your position. You know, you can't have someone say in Counter-Strike, oh, you better aim down 15 pixels to the southeast or whatever to shoot the person. Things are just happening much too fast, and so that really helps solve the problem there. So you don't really need the role playing as much as I think you do in a game like Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, when there's time pressure, a lot of games can handle this problem of people telling you what to do with time pressure. If you're in a team shooter, for example, and somebody tells me what to do, you know, that may bother me. It may make me feel I may like it because they're giving me a tactical direction, but no matter what they tell me, they aren't the ones taking the shot. They're not the ones, seizing the battlement or sniping or whatnot. I'm still doing that.
So when you guys were designing the most co-op game ever, Schizoid, available now on Xbox Live and up for awards, many awards, do you believe that the time pressure is what makes that game work? I can't tell you what to do because there's this pressure of enemies coming in on me. Did you consider that?
Well, Schizoid takes a pretty heavy-handed view toward it in that you literally can't progress unless you're cooperating, and in addition to that, there is the time pressure. It's almost as though the game is forced to be cooperative, and then the time pressure is making you be communicative as well as cooperative. So,
hey, yeah. did you think about a role-playing element?
No.
I'm feeling blue today. Are you feeling red?
I think I'm going to kill red guys today instead of blue for a change.
Actually, one problem that Schizoid does have is because it has the cooperative thing going on at the same time that the time pressure thing's going on, I think people get confused as to, is this a reflex game or is this a puzzle game? And it's both. It's right exactly down the middle. And I think we found through some testing, you know, that's a difficult place to be because there's so few things that are right there. It's more akin to, I don't know, playing a sport really than most computer games. And so you're right in between.
Well, it's team sports are cooperative games.
Well, they're not cooperative in the sense we've been using, where everybody's on the same team. There's team sports typically have two teams, but the dynamics on the team certainly do work similar. And if you view the other team as being the game system or whatever, then it is exactly the same.
Yeah, you can think of cooperative games as two-sided, highly asymmetric games. Maybe you've got a robot playing against you or whatever, but in a lot of ways, they're very similar to sports from the perspective of a particular team.
So,
And actually, the one thing that sports tend to do that's really good is it's very similar, back to the computer, the one-sided cooperative computer games we're talking about, where there's generally this time pressure. It's very difficult for people to play your position. It's impossible for people to play your position, and it's very difficult for them to even tell you a lot of what you're supposed to do. They're generally giving you some big strategy advice, in Team Fortress, if someone tells you to, move to the left and snipe.
Although I should say that you do see some of it, even though sports solves this problem, that we've been talking about of team dynamics. By being very time intensive, you still do get some of that. And if you play like basketball with a much, much better player than everybody else, I've played games where it's just toss the ball to him and you, that's sort of an analogous problem to somebody playing your position.
Yeah, and even worse than that is when someone's maybe not the best player, but they're still telling you what to do.
But they think they are.
well, at least they think they're the coach. You know, the player coach. Everyone's played a pickup game where someone is telling you exactly, like, you need to go here, set me a screen right now, and all this sort of stuff. And that's so it does happen.
It's right. Just, so well, there's two types of two cases there. There's people telling you strategically what to do, and then you're doing it or choosing not to, as you decide. And then there's this person is just better than you, so you should make them play as much as possible, and that can lead to very boring games. I've played games of basketball and Ultimate Frisbee and a bunch of other games where it's basically I just stand there and occasionally toss the ball to the big man.
And that's the right thing to do because that's how you're going to win.
Right, and so they're not playing my position. They're just the only relevant actor on the field, or maybe there's two of them.
So what other cooperative games have you played recently that are interesting?
You lent me Break the Safe, which was a Milton Bradley board game.
Mattel.
Mattel board game, thank you, from a few years back, which I'd never seen. It's got a kind of cool element in that it's got a real clock which ticks down, and so the game itself lasts 30 minutes. So the faster you play, the better you do. But as a turn-based board game, I take my turn, then the turn order goes clockwise, so you're motivated to take your turns fast. I played this with my kids. It's very appropriate for kids. You run around the base and try to find the key to the safe of the evil guy's lair, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And our first game was a photo finish. It was a lot of fun. We did beat it. Although then my kids played with some of their friends, and they had a fun time, but they didn't play anymore. And that was because one of the friends they sat down with told them what moves to make. And so that gets back to, brings us back to this is a general problem with team dynamics in games. It's nice if you for some reason can't be told what to do. Now the time pressure here doesn't really work in the same way as with a sports game or in a computer game, because everybody's not taking their turn at the same time. It's Tyler's turn, and so now everybody can tell him what to do.
Yeah.
And then it's my turn, and everybody can tell me what to do. That's very different than we're all taking our turn at the same time. So if I tell you what to do, then I'm taking away from my effectiveness. It does. So we've got two ways of handling this this problem of people telling each other what to do too heavy-handedly. One is the role-playing, one is the time pressure. Another that you see in a lot of these games is hidden information, which you're not allowed to tell. So in most of these games, there's cards, and you're not allowed to tell people what's on your cards.
Well, I've always found that we just work around that and infer what we have or talk about what we don't have so that we are inversely talking about what we do have.
Oh,
and
Or sometimes you can accidentally drop your card onto the
game. I mean, that's so, it's a really difficult. I
hate when that happens.
I've found hidden information in those games really hard to stick to the spirit of it.
No, it is. It's really tough. The rules in them typically say you can't show other people your cards, but you can talk about general strategy. And so we run into situations like, I'm not telling you what card I have, but I will say that if somebody had something which is generally more than a 3 but less than a 5, I might be advised here. And so then it's very hard to tell. In some games, it works very poorly. Like Pandemic has cards, but it works. It does not work at all like this because you need to know everybody's specific cards. In fact, the rules of the game say you can tell people what your cards are, and then they make this, and then they have this other rule, but you can't show them what you have. Of course, they're on your team, so there's no reason to lie. So it just means that there's a memory game.
Yeah, and so you've outlined three things: role playing, time pressure, and hidden information. Are there others that as game designers you would look at when designing a cooperative game in order to sort of preclude this idea of either the groupthink or the one player taking the lead?
Sure. One thing that does happen in Dungeons & Dragons, and this it's sort of tied to time pressure, so it's not a completely separate subject, but just the general complexity of the situation. And that is where the moves can be so complicated in some of these games that for the average playing audience where you know, let's say your IQ differential is less than 100 or 200 across the group, that you really do need to specialize because there's just too much information going on. Now, sometimes Dungeons & Dragons breaks down because, you know, one person is good enough or has enough experience that they can play everyone's position, but
or think they have enough experience.
Or think they have enough. But most of the time that I've played Dungeons & Dragons, not all the players, but the majority of the players are better at playing themselves than one particular player there is. Now, unfortunately, most of the time I've played Dungeons & Dragons, the worst player in the group probably should just be played by the best player. But the complexity...
Because you typically have a 200-point IQ differential.
I'm just saying. I think that's a really nice situation if you can achieve it, and it's somewhere similar to throwing back to the time pressure that you have in sports or whatever, where it's really not possible to optimally play other people's positions. So I think Dungeons & Dragons leans on that a little bit as well as the role playing aspect. So
yeah, another one is controlling the communication. You see that in team games, like in Bridge. One of the things that's most fascinating about Bridge is that you're not allowed to talk about the game while you're playing it. You have to coordinate with your partner.
The hand signals ahead of time.
You have to coordinate with your partner entirely, supposedly entirely through your bids and your card play, which is a great state to be in. And we've actually made some cooperative games a lot better that way. Like my best experience with Shadows Over Camelot has been playing where there was no communication at all about the game. You couldn't talk strategy. And of course, this is a downside because we're together we're playing a social game and we're not allowed to talk about the game. But on the other hand, the game was much, much more challenging than it had been because when you talked about strategy, it just became too much people... deciding as a group what to play, and then some people were less involved than they would have been.
Right, and that's a huge burden on your play group. That's great for experienced gamers, right? Because you've all sort of decided, hey, we're really interested in the game, and as soon as you move to a group where some people are interested in much more in the social aspect of it than the game, then it's just exactly what you were saying before. The lack of talking can turn people off since their primary goal isn't the challenge.
Although in our group, after we played a little bit without talking, we realized, of course, we could still do the social stuff. We can talk about the movies. We can talk about getting coffee. We can talk about, you can talk about anything you like. You just can't talk about strategy.
Right. But again, that's a relatively experienced group of game players. No, it's not like I can hand that off to my parents or whatever and have them, sort of intuitively know exactly what they can talk about and what they can and what's cheating and what's
there's
not.
Well, There's absolutely no way anybody can play their first game without talking, probably, because you have to know how to play. After that, most people, I think, sort of understand what's strategic about the game. What would be breaking the rule? You can't talk about the game, game moves.
Yeah, but do you really think that all the playgroups, even though they knew what was sort of over the limit to talking about, do you think they all would
limit? I think players, if they don't, I think it doesn't really matter. I mean, if people want as a group an easier experience, they can get an easier experience. They know when I say something which is a strategic direction to you, it's like everybody at the table knows I'm doing it. If they allow it, then that's the group's decision.
That's actually just that one person's decision. It's exactly like just talking about movies. I mean, move it outside the realm of games. We all have, sort of as a group, kind of an understanding of what it means to be a spoiler for a film. And it doesn't mean that as a group we all stick to that. I get very annoyed sometimes when some people say, I don't want to hear the ending. I don't want to hear the ending. Well, let me just tell you something that won't give away the ending. And then, of course, it does. In fact, all know one person in particular that does that.
But that's different, because you're not – like, this is a group of people I'm choosing to play with. And if somebody is moving this in, doing what the group feels is cheating – well, you got to deal with that in any game. What if they're just cheating, or it's like they're breaking the rules. If they're giving strategic advice, if everybody agrees that they're allowed to show other people their cards, then I think that's fine. If you're playing with five people and four of them don't think that's the case, then the other person is simply cheating.
And then what happens? So you're playing a game of Shadows Over Camelot, and
says, "What happens in a regular game?
I got a good hand." You kick them out of the group.
If you catch somebody taking $500 out of the bank in Monopoly?
But that's exactly the same in every game. If you got cheaters, you got to deal with it.
I don't think it's like taking $500 out. It's saying something general about your hand, or
if you're not allowed to, that's cheating.
And then you would kick that person out of playing at the table.
I would stop playing with them if they did it game after game or something like that. I mean, the group sets there's hard rules that you can break, and then there's fuzzy rules. And the thing is that this rule of you can't talk about what you're doing in the game is much, much harder than in most games, right? In most cooperative games. In most cooperative games, they say you can talk generally about strategy, but you can't talk about your cards in specific. That's fuzzy. That's much, much harder if my parents were sitting down to it, to define what that is. But it's much easier to use this rule that you can't talk about the game strategy at all once you know how to play.
Right, but you're telling me that you can't transmit information in a fuzzy way by saying how good or bad you think things are, or how good or bad you think things are going. I mean, that's the sort of thing that I would think would be happening that's fuzzy in that sort of situation.
There still could be fuzzy cases, but I think it's less fuzzy than you can talk generally about strategy but not about cards in specific, which is what most of these games say. And also, in practice, I just I haven't run into that with most of my groups. I find that when you play by the rules as they're written, you're in a fuzzorama. Like, everything's fuzzy, and they constantly are trying to game how much they can tell you based on what the rules are. But once you just say you can't talk about the game strategy, it's much, much easier.
So if you were the game designer and you designed Shadows Over Camelot, would you have published the game with that rule?
I wouldn't make it the default, because you cannot play your first game that way. You have to be talking about it. But I would absolutely have made it an advanced rule. They've already got several advanced rules for players to increase the challenges. They get better, and that's the most satisfying that I've had.
So is the role of the game designer to give the guidelines to the group, or do you expect in any game you design that the play group is going to find their own levels on certain aspects of the game that are fuzzy?
I think if the game designer can make it a less fuzzy, that's a really good thing. I haven't seen that technique actually used in any game other than team games, but not co-op games. I haven't seen any games which may have satisfying lack of communication rules. In D&D, I've played some games where it was. Most D&D games I played, you can talk as much as you like. But then you can transmit official information by using action points. But some games I've played is like you can only say 15 words on your turn and nobody else can answer or something like that. And that's often quite good because then I cannot advise them except in a way which is within the game.
Most of my D&D games, there's open table talk, unless a character's isolated from. But in combat, we can talk and talk and talk, and the DM will just put down his foot and go, okay, let's go. It's time to.
That's what most of my games have been like.
Yeah, and when I think I've played the better games, I played the Dungeon Master actually. When someone's making sort of two exact comments, the Dungeon Master says, you know, you've got 6 seconds on your turn or whatever, which is sort of the role playing wise how long your turn is supposed to be, and they'll just say, hey, you know, keep it short, which is good. I think it's something the Dungeon Master really, a good Dungeon Master really needs to be in control of, and that's part of their job as the referee. If someone's not having fun because someone else is, you know, telling them too much what to do, then they need to remind people that they should be giving, you know, short bursts of information like they would be.
Yeah, so some battle. Some of my best games, however, have been where the Dungeon Master is very heavy-handed on that, where once combat begins, if it's your turn, nobody else is talking. If you want, you can do your action, you do whatever you want to do, and the person who's taking the turn can say something. And so then the communications, sometimes lines get strategic lines get crossed, and people make mistakes more often, and it can be very interesting. And of course, just like with Shadows of Camelot, you can still talk about getting some more coffee or something.
I could use some coffee right now, actually.
Yeah, so can I. I wonder why that analogy keeps on popping up.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's a fifth one, actually.
I was hoping there was.
Yeah. Which is this actually, I guess, doesn't work for cooperative games, but for team games. If you're motivated not to tell people to communicate with people, that also works because a game like Werewolf is that way, where Shadows Over Camelot, where somebody on the team may be a betrayer in Shadows Over Camelot, will be a betrayer in Werewolf, and so being entirely forthcoming is not in your team's interest. You have to, or somebody is motivated not to be forthcoming. Battlestar Galactica, the game, also has something like that, where there's traitors among you. And so once again, you've got a control your information method of cooperative / teamwork game design.
Have you ever seen a game where communication as an in-game currency, like you had mentioned, that spending an action point to make a comment in a D&D game. Have you ever seen a board game that uses, that, you know, combines the currency in the game with communication?
We've talked about it. I don't think I've seen it.
We've talked about it a lot. We really want to do something like that.
I love the idea of a game where people are, whatever, moving around the tracks, trying to solve some a big cooperative a problem or a team problem. And then when your pawn is in a particular space, you're allowed to talk. Right, and so at other times you have to be quiet, and I think something like that would be a really interesting area.
Right on. Well, we'll look for that in the future. We're just about out of time, so any last comments? Let's just close it out with a question. What's your favorite cooperative game?
I guess Dungeons and Dragons with a good dungeon master.
Are you a good dungeon master?
I guess you'd have to ask my players. I think some have said yes.
At some point. Richard, do you have a favorite cooperative game?
I think that role-playing games are the premier cooperative game, and really you can't touch them.
All right, that's 3 for 3. I'll agree with that. So thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening to the podcast. We will be back in a week or so with another one. You can make comments on the blog at the Three Donkeys website. Thank you very much. Good night.